Today's program is brought to you by our neighbors, Fine and Raw Chocolate, producers of the most delicious bean-to-bar chocolates in Brooklyn. For more information, visit fineandraw.com.
Hi, this is Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And we are the co-hosts of Why Food here on Heritage Radio Network.
We've both been huge fans of Heritage Radio since, I don't know, forever. And we are super excited to announce that Heritage Radio is celebrating its 10-year anniversary this year.
Think of 10 years of amazing shows, amazing guests, amazing interviews. You have access to all of those things for free, which is pretty incredible. But we are a nonprofit, and we do depend on your support and ultimately your donations to be able to keep doing this.
So we are doing a big donation drive right now, and we would love to see your support. We also have some really great prizes, including
spices from my spice company, Burlap and Barrel. I will curate a set of 6 spices for anyone who feels generous enough to donate in the $500 category.
So go today to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to help support the overall radio network, or you can support us specifically if you click on Why Food in the designation drop-down menu. Thank you so much for listening to Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening.
Welcome, welcome. This is Why Food Podcast, the podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, creative people who have left their former careers and joined the food, beverage, and hospitality world. I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
I'm Ethan Frisch.
And today we are joined by Alvin Kailan, the incredible chef and restaurateur behind many concepts, including The Usual, Amboy, and Egg Slut. He's also the host of The Burger Show.
What's up, guys? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'll kick it off with, can you tell us about all your concepts? Well, let's leave Egg Slut for last because I think everyone probably already knows that.
Okay.
But tell us about your new work, your babies.
So I'm a new resident in New York City.
Welcome.
I mean, I've been here for about 2.5 years now, but I still feel like it's new. We opened up The Usual, which is an American comfort food restaurant cooked by children of immigrants. That's kind of like our explanation to our menu. And then I think maybe September we'll be able to open Amboy, which is our Filipino grill restaurant.
Why was the children of immigrants concept important to you? Where did that idea come from?
I don't know if it's like what has happened in my career or whatever. I think it's kind of been my goal to have people know where their food comes from and like who makes it and all that stuff. And it's not usually just like food that comes out of a window. And I think a lot of people think that food is either the chef by himself makes
it. You know what I mean? 500 of those
all 500 dishes that come out that night, the one chef made it. And it's not. And you know, I want people to know, like, these guys are, like, the up-and-coming rising stars of this industry, and these are the people who make it. This is the face behind the plate. And so in L.A., all my restaurants were open kitchens just for that reason, so people could see who's making the food. And with The Usual, which is in Nolita, we inherited the restaurant. And so the kitchen's downstairs. It's a completely different, like, setup from what I'm used to. So we definitely, like, put it out there where it's like, okay, this is American comfort food cooked by children of immigrants. And, like, with my staff, it's like, okay, where are you from? We meet every week and we talk about the menu. And it's like, where are you from? Okay. How did you eat fried chicken growing up, or did you eat pasta growing up, or like did you eat noodles growing up, and like what flavors to remind you of your home, and how can we implement that in our dishes? So it turns into like a collective menu development situation, and ultimately the goal is the customer understands where our food comes from, and my cooks take accountability for what they're making because they put their fingerprint on it. So that's kind of like the gist of The Usual. I know it sounds like a lot, but that's kind of, I call it 2019 food.
Yeah.
But it's gotten a lot more. I have to explain it more.
So what does it mean that it's 2019 food? Like what do you feel like is happening today in 2019 in food that's represented in that?
Well, I think like the era of fusion kind of birthed what's going on right now.
Sure.
Which is like, you know, making cacio pepe and then putting Tobiko on top of it. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what we do. You know, we do like a fried chicken, but we put tahini instead of like a spice rub. Like, we make our own style of tahini and we put it on the chicken. And then, like, it's become like the crowd favorite. And like, most recently, we've been doing the burger of the day. And the burger has been the vehicle or the vessel of putting like different flavors and different cultural like influences in the burger. And then the customer will be like, oh, I've never had Japanese curry before. This tastes amazing. And it's like, it's good, right? Like,
and so now that you do have the upstairs downstairs kind of split at the usual. So how have you been able to kind of portray this message without the open kitchen, letting guests know who is cooking their food? Right. And also kind of how has that reaction been?
Well, it's been an evolving thing. Like, first, like, our first line of defense will always be our servers and our hosts, our servers, our general managers, our front of the house team. They'll always be like, hey, have you been here before? If not, this is what we're about. We're an American comfort food restaurant cooked by children of immigrants. All of our dishes are influenced by different cultures that are built in our kitchen or that are from our kitchen. And so we'll explain it like that. And then if the customer doesn't care, like, you know, our runners will say, oh, this is what you ordered. This is what you got. This is where it's from. Okay, enjoy. Walk away. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just kind of do our part and, you know, educating our customers on, you know, the different flavors in our food.
Your career has transitioned in a lot of ways, different, I think, from most of our guests who have a pretty clear, they did something before cooking and now they cook, or they did something before starting a business and now they have their own food business, where you worked for a construction company for a year out of college, but then you've also made several really interesting and pretty significant transitions within food, right? Going from a cart to a restaurant
to a multi-location.
and then pivoting again restaurants into I guess like a fast casual style into more of a
we're a full-service restaurant.
Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for. And then the burger show is a whole other thing. Could you kind of give us the high-level overview of how you walked that path and how it all fits together for you now?
I mean, I was built to be in the kitchen. My first job, 15 and a half years old, was a dishwasher at a retreat house in Alhambra, California.
what was the kitchen like? What was
it was a regular industrial kitchen. Everything was made to make, or everything was built like to make 150 portions of something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we had a huge tilt skillet, like 16 burners, like a 7-foot griddle, you know? Like, it was one of those type of restaurants. And I started there at 15 and a half, and I worked there till I graduated high school. And I went from like dishwasher, janitor, prep cook to eventually working on the line there. And so I've always loved food. And then I'm also a part of that era that like grew up watching Emeril Lagasse, you know, that thing. So I've always had that like love for food and like that gourmet, when the word gourmet was something super important, right? And then I had the reality of being an Asian American, where it was like, my parents really want me to go to college. You know what I mean? So I was like, all right, I'm gonna go to college. I went to college, did my thing, graduated, and got a regular job. And it was for a construction company, and I would be the guy who would bid on the jobs and stuff like that. And it was cool, but at the same time, this is when, you know, the taxpayers were bailing out banks and all this stuff. And a majority of our job was renovating banks. And, you know, at one point we were like putting a $60,000 Italian marble bathroom for an executive. And I was like, this is the reason why my college tuition is so high. I don't know if I should be doing this anymore. And at the same time, it's like, I'll be doing paperwork in my cubicle. And the next thing you know, I'm like looking up a recipe for, you know, barbecue or something like that. And then on Friday, when I got my check, I would cash my check and I would buy like, you know, 10 pounds of pork shoulder. And then I would go and like try to smoke it. You know what I mean? Like, so my passion was always like food. And then one day I was just like, I had it. I didn't tell a soul. And I went to culinary school. And then that's kind of like where my career started at that point. And then, you know, I worked up and down the coast and I did Egg Slut.
Just that casual thing.
Yeah, I did Egg Slut purely because breakfast was not a thing in Los Angeles. You know, like Los Angeles breakfast is drive through Starbucks, get a muffin, get a coffee, sit in traffic for 30 minutes and then you're at your job. So we did Egg Slut then. But yeah, I think to answer your question, I've always been that guy who's kind of recreated themselves. Like, you know, Anthony Bourdain had that tattoo of the Ouroboros. And the way he described it was like his life was always like he's recreating himself and whatever, you know, and I've been that kind of guy. And I think I'm never satisfied. So I'm always trying to do new things and just being able to perfect it. And I think like with Egg Slut, I felt like I hit the level where we made a perfect egg-centered breakfast menu and we hit one market and we perfected that market and like I left it. I was like, okay, this is done. You know, let's do something else.
Was that hard to walk away from?
Yeah.
At first, yeah. You know, like my first, I mean, this was my baby, right? Like mm-hmm. Egg Slut Truck we were in operations for 2.5 years. And I tell people, I would describe my day, which is I would wake up at 2 a.m. and I would drive 45 minutes to Compton to pick up my truck. And while I'm on my truck, you have to let it run for like an hour because it's a 1986 Chevy step van and it was terrible. And then I would drive 2 hours to West Hollywood and then I would prep another 2 hours and open for breakfast. And then we would go downtown for lunch. And then we would drive to Santa Monica to do like happy hour bar food dinner. And then we would stay till 2 a.m. And then I would sleep in my car and do it again the next day. And this was like Thursday, Friday, Saturday when it was like popping. And I was like, I put a lot of brain damage and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into that brand. And then, you know, when we opened our first brick and mortar, it was just like overnight. Everyone was like, it's an overnight success. And I'm like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
It took 3 years to get here. And then, you know, the lines never stopped. So eventually, you know, I've always had this credo, which is, you know, humility, integrity, respect. And this is something that I was taught as a young cook. And I brought that into Egg Slut. And I really, really wished that that was like our credo there. But, you know, as you grow, you know, the bakers can no longer keep up to you. Mm-hmm. You know, the bacon smokers can't keep up to you. So you have to start changing your ingredients. And, you know, that I had such a difficult time with that. So that's when I started to become a diva. And I was just like, hey, dude, you know, we need to change something. But yet the business people were like, we still have a 2-hour line.
Right.
We still have 4.5 stars on Yelp. You just need to chill. And so I was like, you know, maybe you're right. I need to chill. So I took a step back. I gave a lot of my, like, my power to the business people. And I was like, you know what? If this is going to help me progress my life, then you guys can do whatever you want. And I'll just, if you need me culinarily, I'll let you know. But to take over the world, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to advise you on opening a location in wherever. But I will be able to tell you this is how your kitchen should flow, blah, blah, blah. So that's what they keep me for. And I look at it now as more of an investment. And, you know, I'm investing in a company that's doing really well. And that's helping me do other stuff. Like the usual, I did the Unit 120 in LA, which is like this really experimental incubator. And in 1 year, we had like the top 4 restaurants of that year that did incubator stuff at our restaurant. So it was fun. I was able, like, without Egg Slut, I wouldn't be able to do those things. And then now we're at the usual, and it's like me in the kitchen every day. You know, like, it's like I'm back. I'm composing food. So it's fun. Like I said, it's like it's a constant recreation of myself. Like even when I was a kid, from dishwasher to construction to Egg Slut to Egg Slut brick and mortar to going to Chinatown, and helping Chinatown develop their food scene, and then coming to New York, and then and now we're doing the usual. We're doing Amboy and the Burger Show. So it's like,
can we talk a little about Amboy as well, and how it was a pop-up? It's going to open. It is a Filipino concept. You are Filipino. Like, how did you kind of like take this journey and kind of come back to this sort of food?
So Amboy is my, it's me, right? American boy, that's what it means. And like, I've always loved Filipino food. I've always craved Filipino food. Like when I was living in Portland, you know, I was there for a while, and like, I craved Filipino food every day. And then I started realizing like some of the stuff that like I could get at the Filipino store, I can't get there. So I started to like kind of just pivoting my ingredients, and then turning it into something completely my own. And I think like Amboy is basically the culmination of like my career in one restaurant. So with also my culture heavily influenced in it. So it's been a project, and we've been doing pop-ups all over the place. You know, we've done it at Coachella. We've done it at in LA. We've done it on Essex Street here in New York, and it's like people like it. And so I was like, let's do this restaurant. I also have a book coming out, an Amboy cookbook with Houghton Mifflin, and it's basically the story of my life in a dish.
How did you know it was time to, like, you know, like, obviously there's more to your life that will soon be coming. How, right. Like, how do you see the menu changing? And also, how did you know it was time to, like, solidify Amboy now?
Well, I think it was, like, it landed on my lap. Because, you know, this whole incubator thing that we did in 2016, and being able to, like, create Filipino food, and the popularity of Filipino food that came after all of that, you know, it just landed on my lap. It just, you know, it's, I've already been cooking it for so long, you know, like, and then, you know, knowing that I've created a restaurant that has done really well in Egg Slut, and I've done incubators basically consulting and helping other people make their dreams come true. And then coming to New York and then opening a restaurant, knowing that this is probably the hardest market in the country to open a restaurant. It kind of just gave me that like confidence to say, you know what, if I'm going to make my food, I'm going to make it in this city because I live here. And not only that, but like the restaurant's two blocks from my house. And that's like, that's dream.
Yeah, that is the dream.
That is the dream, right? Like opening a restaurant that's two blocks away from your house. Being able to just put your all into it, like, is what you want. And I didn't get that opportunity anywhere else. So why not here?
Spent enough time in LA traffic to really value the 5-minute commute.
No, seriously. Yeah. My entire life, I used to drive from East LA to Manhattan Beach. And I would wake up 2 hours before just to get to work. And then when I did the food truck, I was in the food truck for like 8 hours a day commuting. And it was just, it wasn't ideal. It really took a lot out of you. And now it's like, oh man, I gotta get to work.
Strolling down the street.
And I'm there in 5 minutes. You know what I mean? Like,
it does feel like, and acknowledging that this is a ridiculous thing to say, people in the Philippines have been eating Filipino food for a very long time.
Yeah.
But Filipino food is having this kind of trendy moment in the United States.
Yeah.
What do you think that is from, and how do you see yourself fitting into that broader scene?
How do you feel about the word trend?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is I think that like Filipinos are speaking up. My parents would never, whenever we had parties and other cultures were invited, we did fried chicken, we did spaghetti, we did that stuff. We hid all the good Filipino food for us on Monday through Friday. But us first or second generation Americans or Filipino Americans, we're like, you know, I'm pretty proud of this. So I'm going to go ahead and be vocal about it. I'm going to talk about it. And I think that's where we're at now, where like a lot of these chefs that are making Filipino food that are Filipino are like, dude, this is really good food. You should try it. You know what I mean? And then it kind of like caught fire. And then now there's like, you know, like there's other cultures making Filipino food. And that's like really awesome. You know, like to see, it's like we're getting there. And I think we're almost getting to the past. We're getting past the point of being a trend. I think now it's like starting to get into regionality and all this stuff. So, you know, at the end of the day, like, it's good to be a part of, you know, it's good to be a part of that whole, like, wave of Filipino popularity, and I'm happy with it.
Do you have favorite Filipino restaurants in New York?
Besides your own.
Oh, man. You know, there's a place for everything. You know, like, we have... New York represents the Filipino food scene in all spectrums, right? Where it's like fast food, Jollibee. I love that, right? It's like, they just opened one in Manhattan. And I'm like, oh my God, it takes everything for me to not go there every day. But yeah, Jollibee is like one of my favorite things on that spectrum of Filipino food. And then like, you know, like this is the Tito Rad's in Queens where it's like, oh dude, it's like my aunt's house, you know, or the lady's like, all right, you're up next. You know, like, okay, cool. What do you want? You want, and they look at you and I'm like a big dude and they're like, oh, you want the sisig, huh? And I'm like, you know, it's like, no. But yes, I'll have the seasoning.
I didn't say eat it.
Yeah. And then there's like the spots in Jersey City that are fantastic. You know, I go to Jersey City. I try to go to Jersey City every Sunday to go to the Phil stop there, which is like the big Filipino market. So, I mean, like, those are like my favorite places to go. Those are like my weekly frequents, you know. And I don't even think like the people at Tito Rad's knows who I am. They just look at me like the dude who likes to eat Filipino food. Because when I go there, I throw it down, man. But yeah, those are the spots in New York. And then in LA, it's a different story. Like I grew up there, so like there's like the buffet well of Filipino food that's okay. Like probably been sitting there for like 8 hours. I still love that.
It just means the chicken is more tender.
It's
more slow cooked.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I still love that stuff. So those are the places I go to in LA, you know?
How do you feel about, we were talking a little bit about this at lunch, like now that there are so many different cultures being represented in New York and LA, and there are obviously people of other cultures cooking that culture's food, where is the line of, you know, do you want to go support them, but are there caveats to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I said, I love making other stuff. Like, I've been getting really into, like, Israeli food because, you know, Ori is a good friend of mine from Bovel and Bessie in L.A., and, like, Bovel, like, blew my mind. Yeah. So I'm like, how do I perfect making hummus? And, like, I do a roti at The Usual. And it like takes a lot. It took a long time to make that puffy flatbread. You know what I mean? It's like, so when it comes to you, it's like nice and bulbous and like just steaming hot. Like, and I don't want anyone to judge me for that because I'm Filipino. Like I shouldn't be making that. So the only thing I do have a problem with when it comes to other cultures making other cultures food is when they tell you this is how you're supposed to eat it, or this is the cleaner version of this food. That kills me. Because it's like, dude, you can't say that. Like, you just crossed the line. Like, you're not the authority. I don't think anyone's the authority to be able to draw that line, you know? And when people start to do that, then that's when I have problems with that whole cultural appropriation subject.
Do you have thoughts on the word authenticity or authentic?
Oh yeah.
That's a good question that we ask a lot.
So Filipino food and having really strict aunts and uncles, that comes up a lot, right? Like, but authenticity is what you make it, you know, like, my traditions are different from your traditions, or even if we were all Filipino in this room, my traditions were probably different from yours and blah, blah, blah. So the whole word authentic and all that stuff it's vague.
Yeah.
It's that clause in like a legal contract where you're just like, nope, you got to describe that more. authentic is not a good word, you know, like it's not accurate. So yeah, that there's no such thing.
Yeah. I saw a video, Leah Cohen had done of her version of something.
Leah Cohen, who's the chef
at Pig and Cow.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, this is not authentic, because it was described by Tasty as being authentic, even though in the video she clearly says this is mine, but they thought that would get more hits or SEO, who knows, or just kind of to sell her in a certain way, and it was too bad because then everybody got into a fight about it.
Yeah, no,
and
it's like weird.
Everyone.
That particular restaurant, as a group of like Filipino friends that will talk about Filipino places and Filipino chefs, that's like a common thing, the authenticity thing, where because she actually gives you chopsticks at a restaurant, And we're like, okay, she does Thai food and she does Filipino food. Both those cultures don't use chopsticks. Why is there chopsticks there? But at the same time, it's like, who fucking cares? Oh, sorry.
No, you can go ahead.
Okay. Internet radio, say whatever you want.
Yeah, like, who cares?
Yeah, she can do what she wants.
Yeah. Dude, like I said, 2019 American food in America is everything. Like, you know what I mean? Like, people are making cheeseburger dumplings and there's a line out the door.
Yeah,
a lot of people are turning in their graves for that. But it is what it is.
Yeah.
It's our fault as food lovers because we want to push those limits. That's such an American thing to do, you know? Like, we want to explore that. We're cowboys in a sense, you know? So it's like, you know, it is what it is. You know, it is what it is. I mean, I know a lot of people are probably going to give me flack for this, but at the same time, it's like, dude, like, I know people who make such weird food, and I see, like, when I eat the food, because I've read cookbooks and all this other stuff, I know that this is almost Muslim. This is, you know what I mean? Like, in one dish. And it's great. So why are we stopping that? You know what I mean?
I think the other thing, though, is that we're sort of stuck, right? Like, there's obviously there's a lot of Americas.
Yeah.
And there are portions of the country who are where you are, right?
Yeah.
Thinking about what food in America in 2019 looks like, embracing the multiculturalism, yeah, embracing the pollination that happened across. But then there are also a lot of people who, for whom that's kind of overwhelming or scary or intimidating, or yeah, who are not there where you are.
Right. There's a place for that, though. Like, there's people who just do heirloom food.
Okay.
And that's fine, because at that point, you're educating people. But where we're at now, as a majority, if I could speak for the majority of, like, culinarian people or even chefs, there's no more boundaries. It's like, we're going to put gochujang on things. Yeah,
just on whatever.
And a hot dog. Yeah. It's cool. It's fine, you know? You know, we're going to try to make our version of gefilte fish or whatever. You know, it is what it is. And that's kind of like what makes 2019 food so awesome, or now food now awesome, is that, like, you know, we're developing new recipes and techniques. And I think that in the food world, that constant regeneration and, like, that constant, like, recreation of stuff is what keeps it going, you know? We're always going to want to eat, but we're also always going to want to explore. It's just in our nature.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
Today's program is brought to you by our neighbors, Fine and Raw Chocolate. They make bean-to-bar chocolate and confections in HRN's backyard here in Brooklyn. Fine and Raw is committed to sustainably sourcing their cocoa beans directly from organic cocoa farmers. They use minimal processing and stone grinding to accentuate chocolate flavor and aroma. Their chocolate is sweetened exclusively with unrefined coconut sugar, which blends delicious caramel notes into the chocolate. Crafted for chocolate lovers, all of Fine and Raw's bars, truffles, and spreads are 100% plant-based. From creamy bars blended with nut butter to salt-sprinkled dark chocolate, sweet truffle bars to toasty coconut dulce de leche, Fine and Raw is obsessed with creating next-level flavors. Their chocolate hazelnut butter made with the best Oregon hazelnuts is the best thing you could ever eat with a spoon. It begs to be drizzled on ice cream, waffles, strawberries, you get the idea. Above all, Fine and Raw is a community of people dedicated to the idea that chocolate is magic. Visit fineandraw.com for your chocolate fix.
Are you enjoying this podcast?
Heritage Radio Network has plenty more.
I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Brandon Hoy.
And I'm Emily Pearson. Together we host The Main Course OG, where we cover food news and culture. Browse episodes of The Main Course OG wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. We are joined this week by Alvin Kailan, who is a chef and a host of the Burger Show and all kinds of cool stuff. We were just talking before the break about what it means to cook in 2019.
Yes.
And your new restaurant, The Usual, is sort of an example of that.
Mm-hmm.
But you've also, you were telling us over lunch, have had some pushback. Tell us about the sign outside the restaurant and the whole story around that.
So like I was saying earlier, our credo or like the theme of our restaurant is American comfort food cooked by children of immigrants. And it just dawned on us a few weeks ago to like write it on our chalkboard frame and put it outside. And I took a picture of it on the internet and the picture blew up. And it was weird because some people were like, yeah, right on. And then other people were like, dude, you guys hire illegal immigrants? And I'm like, I didn't even put the word illegal on that chalkboard.
What does the sign say?
It says American comfort food cooked by children of immigrants. And the word immigrant, for some reason, turns into illegal. And so we started to get a wave of comments. We've actually gotten reviewed on Google reviews saying, don't eat here. They hire illegal immigrants.
What?
on our, just based off of what it says on a chalkboard. And like, I'll sit, you know, yesterday we do fun things and like, it might be not the cool, like the legalist thing to do, but like, I brought out a plancha outside and I started cooking burgers because it was so beautiful outside. And that's kind of like my spirit of like how I do things is like, whatever, man, if they tell me to shut down, I'll just
go back inside to my restaurant. Yeah.
But yeah, I was, you know, and standing outside and I would see people scoff at the A-frame and I'm like, what's your problem? Like, you know, in my head, I'm like, what's your problem? Like, well, what is so wrong about the word immigrant? Mm-hmm. And, you know, people were just going crazy off of it. Like, DMing me saying, yo, dude, like, there's a process. This word, the process. Was like brought up 100 times. And I'm like, yeah.
What is the process?
To become an American citizen.
Immigration process.
Yeah, there's an immigration process. I'm like, yeah, I'm not saying anything about that. My parents went through that. You know, like luckily I was born here and I didn't have to go through that. A lot of my cooks are going through that, the naturalization process.
Oh, yeah. It's a miserable process. And, I can attest.
Yeah. And then at the end of it, there's like this big like Star Spangled Banner event and all this stuff. And like I went to my mom's and my dad's when like, you know, 20 years ago, when I was like a kid. And like I'm not even saying anything about that stuff. And honestly, like for people out there who don't know, you can't give an employee a payroll check if they aren't legal to work in America. That is just the facts. No one is hiring illegal immigrants. No restaurant, because of the margins of their profit margins, can pay or afford to pay a dishwasher under the table. Because how are you gonna justify that through the IRS? Mm-hmm. It's impossible, unless you're already cheating the government. Then that's an even bigger that's a more serious issue. But I'm not, you know, like you can't do that. It's almost impossible to do that unless you're already cheating the system in the first place. So, like, you know, and I didn't just sit there and take it to the chin. I would comment back like, what if, like, they're like, oh, like, what if, did they enter the country illegally? And I'm like, what if they did? I don't know. You know, but they're here and they are legal to work.
Yeah. And now they're working on it because yeah. Maybe they had extenuating circumstances.
Exactly. And, you know, and it's also hard for me to take that criticism from people who've never had to go through that process.
Where do you think that comes from?
Honestly, I think it's just the climate of where it is right now. You know, our president, you know, is very vocal about it. You know, it's almost become like an everyday topic on Twitter. So it's just something that like we're exposed to more than we've ever been ever as a society. And like, that's where it is. You know, a lot of people have, especially in the internet world, a lot of people have like the courage to talk crap. And like, it's like, okay, well, why don't you just come over to the restaurant and see it for yourself? Yeah.
So has that process or that feedback that you've gotten, has mm-hmm. that changed the way that you're approaching the food that you're making, the way that you're talking about
it? It's affected my entire staff. It's definitely like people like, you know, I hate using the term woke, but they're definitely they're awake as hell right now in my restaurant where, you know, they now understand like, look, that's why this is why we do this. Mm-hmm. This is why we're making this food. It wasn't just words. Before it was just words. Now that we posted it online and people reacted the way they reacted, now it's like, okay, we're taking this seriously, you know, which is why now we're starting to do the burger of the day, right? And the burger of the day is our way of being able to put like different cultures into something so relatable, which is a burger. And like last night we did like the curry burger, the Japanese curry burger. We've done a burger with like Espanol and Papa's Bravas. We've done like, we've made one with Maggi seasoning and chopped chilies. We've done all kinds of stuff to where like Maggi seasoning is something that's in every cupboard of like any Southeast Asian person's house. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
and in Germany, apparently.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, I think it was like a maybe Swedish invention because they didn't have soy sauce. So they created their own soy sauce and that's where Maggi came from.
Really?
Yeah. That's the story of Maggi. They didn't have soy sauce readily available. So the laboratory just made one. It's awesome. Thank you. Shout out to Maggi. But yeah, that's our now thing. Like, and our cooks are like, they're loving it because it's like, okay, this is how I'm going to put my influence into mm-hmm. this burger. And I'm so happy that's kind of what's developed from all of this, because at the end of the day, we're a restaurant and restaurants thrive off of good food. So
I also want to call back to the point, something you mentioned earlier on the show is that, you know, you had all open kitchens. Now, because of the upstairs, downstairs, you have the sign. Like, why was it so important for people to literally see, whether it's in through words or face to face, who was cooking there for
you?
Well,
like I was saying before, like, you know, like people need to understand, like, the people who touch your food are the people that you might hate. You know, they're... And it is what it is. That's just the nature of the restaurant industry. And it's like, you know, the food, no matter what you think, it doesn't just come from a hole in the wall. It comes from love and passion and work and hard, you know, blood, sweat, and tears. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, I really want people to know that. Especially, and it was never just like, oh, for like white people. It was like, dude, my parents don't know that. My grandparents don't know. My parents and I did not talk for 4 years because they thought that being a cook was beneath me.
Mm-hmm. Same.
You know? Like, this is the reason that drives me to do what I do. Because I've been told no my entire life on certain things because of who I am. Like, my parents were more prejudiced to me than other people because they're like, dude, you need to assimilate. You need to be more like them. Mm-hmm. And it's like, nah. I'm not. You know what I mean? Because I'm clearly different. So that's I've always been that way. Like I said, LA, we did open kitchens. New York, we're now the corner of Elizabeth and Kenmare, the voice of like the immigrant cook. You know what I mean?
And especially given that immigrants and especially illegal immigrants have been the backbone of the restaurant industry in the United States as long as there have been restaurants.
And some of the most amazing food are made by people who are not from here. And also, like, just on like the topic of your show, it's like a lot of us assimilated and did work before.
Right. And that's a frequent.
Yeah. A lot of us wanted to fit in. You know, we worked for the Con Eds. We worked for those guys, Verizon, whatever. But we also love food. And that's why we went back. And some of the most amazing food come from people who had that epiphany. You know, had that like life-changing moment where like, you know what, I'm going to follow my dreams. I'm going to make that food dream happen. And that's just the nature. That's as American as apple pie.
Yeah.
Literally. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
What is it about the burger in particular that attracted you and is sort of a vehicle for communicating about different ingredients, different flavors that white people or Americans who haven't had a whole lot of exposure to other cuisines that gives it's an entry point for them.
It's really just my history with burgers. So I grew up, my best friend, his parents owned a teriyaki bowl spot in our neighborhood. And one of my first favorite burgers before In-N-Out was a teriyaki cheeseburger. And that in itself was like, oh man, this is Japanese and it's a burger. So I was conditioned at a really young age that burgers were an international thing, right? Then growing up in a Mexican neighborhood and, you know, like eating like burgers that were on the griddle, on the same griddle of carne asada and having that flavor onto the burgers and eating burgers with like guacamole or salsa, that was a thing. So that it's always been there a part of my life. And you know, I've always been an aficionado for burgers. That's always been a passion of mine. And I think a lot of chefs are the same way, where though we make like different composed dishes, at the end of the day, like making a composed burger is always fun. And that's why it almost shows like your DNA on your menu. If you have a burger on the menu, it's kind of like, oh, I'm not that serious of a chef. Like, I'm going to be able to put a burger on my menu. So that, I mean, that's really the evolution of like where we're at now with like doing the burger of the day. You know, plus the sign, all of those forces really push us to make a really delicious burger at the end of the night. And it's only available after 10.
Oh.
Yeah, it's only available after 10, and we're open till midnight, so you have a two-hour window to come in and have a nightcap and have a burger, right? And also, because I'm, like, the host of the burger show, like, my staff knows the burgers have to be amazing, because people are like, I watch this show all the time, I'm going to go have a burger, and we're always like, yeah, come after 10, you know what I mean? Like, so, yeah, my staff is very... very hardcore about their burger action right now.
And as you said, you've been reinventing yourself over and over, kind of, you mentioned over lunch, you were trying to escape always being the slut with Egg Slut, right. And now you're kind of the burger person. How did that happen? And how has the burger show changed the, you know, public perception of what do you do?
Okay. So like I said, body by burger aficionado. I've always loved burgers. To the point I was obsessed with Bob's Burgers, the cartoon, and I was invited to go to a table read at Bob's Burgers, and I was like, oh dude, I'm in heaven right now. And I met I met everyone. I met Lauren Burchard, and I met Janelle Monáe, like they the producers of this thing, and I was like, what if I did a Bob's Burgers pop up? And so I did a Bob's Burgers pop up. At Unit 120, and it was a success. Moved to New York, did a pop-up in New York, a Bob's Burgers pop-up, and 400 people would line up in the dead of winter for these burgers. And it caught wind, and at the same time, First We Feast was developing a burger show, and Justin Bolus, who directs the show, we've done work together in the past, and we've always been in deep conversations about burgers and where the best burgers are. And like, we mutually love the Apple Pan in Los Angeles. And so he reached out to me and was like, hey, what do you think about hosting this show? And I'm like, is it going to be one of those like burger shows where we go to each restaurant and like critique the burgers, or is it going to be a little bit more like deeper than that? He's like, it's going to be 100% deeper. We're going to explore regionality. We're going to explore like, you know, like the Baller Burger and like the Roadside Burger and like, you know, like the Dive Burger, but not in a specific location, but why it's there. And I was like, I'm in. So he asked me to be a part of the burger show, and I was like, let's do it. And we just wrapped our fourth season, which is out now on YouTube. So check it out.
And do you have a favorite burger in New York?
Are you allowed to say these things?
Yeah. Oh well, man. You know what? In New York, my New York hug of a burger would be JG Melon. I love that burger. I'm not too much of an advocate for thick patties, but that is a great burger, especially late at night. You know, and with a couple beers.
What do you love about it?
Everything, you know, like, and I go to the one in the Upper East Side, the excitement of when you're walking up and you just see this gigantic green and red or neon red JG Melon sign, and then you walk in and you just see like the mahogany and the green like gingham like tablecloths, and then like the watermelons on the wall, and like the old lady taking your order. Like, I love all of that. Like, the last time I was there, our server was like, I just learned how to take selfies. You want to take a selfie with me? And I'm like, dude, this is why I love this place. And then you see this tiny griddle and like burgers on it. You walk by, you see it, and you smell the burgers cooking, and then you finally get it, and it's just like beautiful bun, super seared patty, the gooey cheese. It's super comforting.
I think, can we just end the show now and go get a burger?
Go get a burger.
I'm totally sold.
Yeah, well, it's super good.
What are your thoughts on what is the bun? you know?
It's all a matter. Like, Peter Luger, they do this really thick 8-ounce burger patty with dry-aged beef that, like, they don't rest. It just starts to seep out all the burger juices. But they have, like, a really, like, almost crusty bun. And it's perfect for it because it sops up all of that good juice. Mm. The bun is something that you have to think out. Like, if you're constructing a burger, you have to choose the right bun for it. You can't just buy a seeded bun and think it's going to be great. It'll be a good burger, but it might not be like a transcending, oh my God, burger. You know what I mean? So I think the bun is 50% of the way. Patty's 50, bun's 50.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Dude, when's the last time you've had a burger without cheese?
It's been a while.
Try it. It's great. Because it's been, you know, I have it for me. I always get cheeseburgers, and one day I just decided to flip the script. I'm like, you know, I'm going to get without cheese. And I did this at a restaurant called Beeps in San Francisco. And I was like, dude, why don't I eat this more often? Like, it doesn't really need the cheese.
Did you have other condiments on it?
Like, no, nothing. There was onion.
Okay.
There was onion and pickles.
But no ketchup, no mustard.
They have that beep special sauce, but I didn't need the cheese, and the bun was perfect. And then they even had this big sign that says locally made, like from the bakery. And there's like an arrow, and there's a bakery across the street. Oh. It's so rad.
That's awesome.
But yeah, like I think the bun is 50% all the way. I truly, and also heated or not heated.
The bun.
Mm.
Yeah, so like the crappy, like almost Wonder Bread bun, don't heat those. Don't toast them because they turn into cardboard. So they have like that fluffy, cakey texture for a reason. So don't put a hot ass burger in there and then let that residual heat from the burger cook the bun, and it'll transcend into greatness. But if you toast it, it ruins the burger.
Really?
Yeah, and then brioche. You gotta toast that. Because if not, it is a dry, buttery mess.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you just taste like you're eating almost like a stale donut.
Yep.
Yeah, that's how it feels if you don't toast it. There's a whole science. I'm, like, hardcore about burgers.
Yeah, yeah.
We should have just done the whole show on
burgers.
Oh, yeah, dude. I'm telling you. I'm very hardcore. I feel like that was, like, I was meant to host that show.
we're going to kick it off with our fast-paced last few minutes of the show. And I would like to go first because I have a question.
Okay.
Now that we're on burgers. In-N-Out or Shake Shack?
In-N-Out.
You live here now.
I know. And I love Shake Shack. Don't get me wrong. But In-N-Out is not a burger place for me. In-N-Out is where I went to when I got good grades. In-N-Out was where I would go to after I got a shot at the doctor to comfort myself. You know, it's not a burger place for me. it's more than that, you know. But again, like, I love Shake Shack. Mark Rosati, those guys are really good friends of mine. And when I'm in New York and it's like 9:30 at night and I'm watching a baseball game, I'm going to hit them up on Postmates. But In-N-Out is... It's if you ask me Five Guys, Shake Shack, I'll pick Shake Shack all day, right? Or damn, that actually I can't even vouch for that either.
The best burger is the most nostalgic burger.
Yeah, you relate to it. I mean, we are burger connoisseurs from such a young age. You know, if you ask my niece who's like 6 years old, she'll tell you no ketchup, no cheese, none of that, just meat, bread. That's all
she
wants.
She's been well trained.
Yeah, you trained her.
And you're like, wow, okay. But then any other kid is the same way. They're just like, no, I want my burger a certain way. And then when you're in high school and, you know, you're with your friends, you order it a certain way. Like, I remember, like, finding out the hacks at Jack in the Box when I was in high school. Like,
there are hacks at Jack in the Box?
Yeah. Like, I was like, you can get a double cheeseburger and get that with the sourdough bread.
What?
Yeah, and you can.
What?
Dude, yeah, they used to have sour cream packets because they used to have a fajita on the menu, and we would get a burger with sour cream.
Was it good?
No. But we did it because, like, they gave it to you. They did it. There was no upcharge on the sour cream. They just gave you, like, this weird packet of sour cream, and you would just almost dollop it onto your each bite. But yeah.
If you could master any skill overnight, what would it be?
Oh, that's easy, man. I'd want to be able to do croissants.
What kind of croissants would you do? Like, just with plain croissants?
Yeah. Any laminated dough, because it is literally my Achilles heel. Like, I try all the time, and it just never works out. Like, and it hurts. You know what I mean? It hurts why I can't nail this thing. And I'm like, I train myself to be super focused, and, like, for some reason, it just never comes out like Maison Kaiser or, you know, Supermoon. You know, when you just taste, and you know what it is? Is that I do it by hand. And I think that if I had a sheeter, this would be a completely different conversation.
You can go to B Patisserie in San Francisco and probably
I used to do morning buns. I did like 30 a day when I had a food truck. And some days they were life-changing. And some days they were like, yo, you didn't let this, like, proof long enough. And like, no. So, yeah, I think laminating dough, maybe even being a baker would be something.
It's funny. Most people who we ask that question to, our guests on the podcast, don't, even though they all work in food.
They are
food. I think you're the first one to have a food-related answer. It's usually like play an instrument or speak a language or.
Yeah.
Being a Formula One racer is probably a real close second.
All right.
You know, but I don't have the physique for that. So that's not happening.
If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Oh, man, teleporting.
Aha! Yes.
Yeah, but that's the...
I know.
So this is the most common answer we get to that question. It's either flying or teleportation.
Yeah.
And what we found generally... Mm-hmm. Jenny, you want to...
Is that women will say teleporting, but men will say flying.
Oh, really?
And we've been theorizing why this is. Okay. And we're like, is it because the men want to be seen to fly place to place and the women just want to get there? Or what is it?
I don't know, man. It's probably Top Gun. I don't know.
Oh, like, yeah? Could be that. You know,
is this something about that? Or me being a Los Angelino, teleporting was always the dream because of traffic.
Yeah.
You know, like it was a common conversation in my car. I was like, imagine if we could teleport, man, we'd be there right now. And you know, in a superhero sense, like teleporting would be awesome, right? Like you could, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to like kill the Avengers, but like teleporting was a huge role in the Avengers Endgame. So,
yeah.
What's up? Yeah.
Alvin, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, man.
Where can our listeners find you, find your food?
Come eat and hang out.
Yeah, go to the usual. It's at 30 Kenmare in Nolita. Egg Slut will probably be in a city near you. If not, we're in all over Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and all over everywhere. And Amboy's coming up. That's also going to be in Nolita on Mulberry. You can find me at The Burger Show on YouTube and or at Alvin Kailon on all social media. Super easy. At my full name, Golden.
Perfect. Well, I'm Jenny Dorsey, and you can always find me at Chef Jenny Dorsey, and you can find us at Why Food Podcast. If you have nominations, questions, thoughts, please email us at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org.
You can find me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on social, Ethan at burlapandbarrel.com. And thanks to Jeet Paul, our awesome sound engineer, and to the Red Crickets for our theme song, Blind. And thanks for listening. See you next week.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.